From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Scott Morrison has restored industrial relations to Cabinet, and the government is flagging efforts to take stronger action against elements of the CFMEU. At the same time, the ACTU, with its Change the Rules campaign, will be out on the hustings at next year's election. So industrial relations is shaping up as a significant issue in the coming months with, given the polls, questions about what a shortened government would do in this area. Brendan O'Connor is Labor's workplace relations spokesman and he joins us today. Brendan O'Connor, Industrial Relations Minister Kelly O'Dwyer has said the government will make every effort to pursue the government's Ensuring Integrity Bill, which is having trouble in the Senate. This legislation would facilitate action against some elements of the CFMEU, but Labor opposes the bill. What are your objections and would you be open to it with some amendments?
This bill is just another example of the obsession of the Abbott Turnbull Morrison government in attacking workers and attacking organised labour. This is, of course, following a royal commission into the entire trade union movement, the establishment of the ABCC and the establishment of the Registered Organisation Commission, which, of course, is now in disrepute as a result of the actions by the former minister, Senator Cash. And so this bill, of course, is being introduced, or we think will be introduced by the government, a government that's desperate to find unity, and it seems to me the only unifying sort of principle it can find is an enmity towards working people and attack on unions. And that's, I guess, our view of it, that it's politically motivated. It's not specific to any particular union. It applies to the Nurses Federation, as it would apply to the CFMEU or, for that matter, any other registered organisation. And it goes much further than the commission, the Dyson-Heydon Royal Commission's recommendations. It does not even compare with the obligations against corporations. So its rhetoric, the government's rhetoric, Michelle, is that it compares with obligations on directors of companies. That's utterly untrue. It exceeds it in many respects. And I can't see this bill in any way being salvageable. And that's why, of course, it's sat for a year without the Senate debating it, because the government can't find sufficient support.
Do you think there's any chance that the government might find support among the crossbenchers in the next few months?
I think it's highly unlikely. The reason it's been unable to get support for 12 months now, it's not a new bill, it's an old bill, is because there are very unfair provisions that are completely and utterly targeted towards organised labour. For example, the bill, the government claims the bill mirrors the laws governing corporations. That is false. There is no fit and proper person test for running a company, although there is a fit and proper test in this bill. There is no proposed, the proposed public interest test for union mergers does not reflect corporate merger tests. There is no express bar to corporate mergers based on previous wrongdoing, although there is here for mergers of unions. The bill imposes harsher penalties than currently apply to disqualified company directors. So there are many, many provisions, well beyond, as I said, the Royal Commission's recommendations and well beyond the obligations to companies. And the crossbench understand that. They've been briefed. They've of course, listened to employers and listened to unions and listened to the opposition. And I'm sure they've had other advice. And they've concluded that this bill is really a political attack on the labour movement, nothing less.
Do you reject the proposition that the construction section of the CFMEU is a problem?
Look, we've always said that there are problems with breaches, civil breaches. I think there's been highly exaggerated claims made against unions. If you want to actually start assessing a union's conduct, you might want to start by at least accurately describing what offences that may arise. And in the respect of union breaches in particular, overwhelmingly they're civil breaches, and that includes the construction unions. And we don't condone breaches of civil law, but let's be very clear here. Executives and directors of the Commonwealth Bank have been accused of failing to take steps to prevent banks from breaching anti-money laundering regulations on more than 50,000 occasions. This has only happened, of course, because of the Royal Commission that we forced the government into. And yet, I don't hear the government attacking what is far more scandalous conduct by employers and companies because of, as I say, their obsession with attacking unions. Now, that's not to say we will condone breaches.
And so would you deal with those breaches?
Well, I think firstly we need to... You don't start by being elected to government and setting up a Royal Commission into every union in the country. That's exactly what the Abbott government did in 2013. Without notice, it established a Royal Commission for 2 years. It spent $80 million, or at least $80 million, of taxpayers' money targeting unions to attack the federal opposition, in effect. And what was found? There's not one custodial sentence. There's been very little found. In the case of the Royal Commission into Banks, by way of comparison, in 1 week, we saw the scale of the corruption and misconduct. And of course, the government resisted for at least a year the introduction of that commission. So it's very hard to take this government seriously when it politicises institutions it establishes and uses those institutions for political purposes, as we saw with the criminal conduct of Minister Cash's office in unlawfully leaking to the media about police raids on AW officers. So this government really has no standing and no regard for the rule of law when it actually acts unlawfully itself and then wants to attack other organisations for acting unlawfully. It's really, I guess it's really very difficult for the government to show that it's acting in, you know, honourably and acting in the national interest.
But I think the point is that Labor could be on the brink of government within months, and people wonder what Labor would do in government about rogue action by some union officials.
Well, as I say, we won't condone that conduct. We've condemned it when there is improper behaviour.
But can you stop it?
Well, can this government stop all behaviour? Can government stop all behaviour in the corporate world? We should be aiming to stamp it out when it's improper, and certainly when it's unlawful. One of the ways I think we might want to try doing that is to bring back greater cooperation in sectors of our economy, in our labour market. For example, I have sat down now with many construction companies and privately discussed with them the need to see greater cooperation in workplaces, and I've done the same with construction unions. And I think if there was less conflict or less targeting of unions by the state, by the federal government in this case, then I think you'll see a greater level of cooperation. And it will certainly undermine those who choose to act in a roguish manner. Because what you say is there should be goodwill and cooperation, there should be mutual beneficial outcomes from industrial negotiations, and it's in the interests of the sector and of the nation that stakeholders, employers and unions, act in that manner. And I don't think that's been tried. And for the last 6 years or 5 years, the current government really has only been a government in conflict with working people, never seeking to work together with business and unions at the table. I mean, it's a government that has never had the unions at the table, whereas Labor will always have unions and business around the table.
Now, you committed to getting rid of the Building and Construction Commission. What, if anything, would you replace that with?
Well, we've said we don't agree with two sets of laws for working people. We've seen the incidence of fatality and injury in the building industry rise since the creation of the recreation of the ABCC. It cowers workers into not raising health and safety concerns in the second most dangerous industry in the country, which has led, as it did under the Howard government, led to a very significant increase in fatalities and injuries. We don't support an institution like the ABCC, which is fundamentally at odds with our ILO conventions that we've ratified, that's inconsistent with international law and international covenants. So we think it is an undemocratic approach to workplace relations. The fact that we've given a civil regulator like the ABCC such police state powers is unconscionable, and Labor doesn't support it. As I say, what we will do is make sure we have, of course, if there are breaches of law, we will have, there will be consequences, there will be fines for anyone who breaks the law, and we will seek to bring greater cooperation, not just into the building industry, but into all sectors of our economy. I think one of the great failings of this government, Michelle, is they had an opportunity, probably more likely under Turnbull than Abbott, to involve stakeholders in the future direction of the country and not allow those stakeholders to abrogate that responsibility by shutting them out. And when you shut out unions, you shut out not only their inclusion in decision-making of structural changes of our nation and our economy, you also, in a sense, let them off the hook because they get to say, well, why should I be involved in fixing a structural problem? I'm not even allowed to sit at the table with the government. That was a great mistake, a strategic mistake made by a government too often, blinded by ideology, not wanting to consult with unions. Now, you take, for example, Angela Merkel, who's not a progressive politician, a remarkable one she might well be, a conservative politician, but she certainly sits down with business and unions when she talks about the direction of her nation. Why can't a conservative leader in this country show that maturity and that sort of inclusiveness that she has shown?
Now, there's a strong prospect that this time next year you'll be Workplace Relations Minister. Your brother is National Secretary of the CFMEU. Do you see any conflict of interest, and how would you deal with that?
Look, there's always a perceived conflict of interest. Either there can be a commercial conflict of interest that I think the former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull had to deal with. There are familial conflicts or perceived conflicts that can arise for any minister who might have a family member involved in decision making. In the case of Malcolm Turnbull, he had a very successful and capable wife who was involved in infrastructure. Well, she was the chief infrastructure advisor of the New South Wales government, there in her own right, and every right to that position. But yet, there's a perception, there could be a perception, you have to avoid that at all costs.
Would you stand back from cabinet decisions involving that union?
Well, look, can I say, if I'm making decisions about that, I've already shown that I do that. When I was last a minister involved in making actual decisions that are where a union is the applicant in the case of an anti-dumping decision, it was my responsibility as Minister for Home Affairs and Customs to determine the outcome of an anti-dumping application in which the forestry division of the CFMEU, well, actually the whole CFMEU, were involved in. And because I was making a decision in which that union was a party, I referred that matter in its entirety to the then Attorney General, Robert McClelland, and I took no role and did not speak with Rob McClelland on that matter, and he determined that matter because that union was party to the application.
So you'd stand back from decisions?
Well, as I say, with respect to policy, the policy's developed, and as you've said yourself, our policy's pretty clear, and it's determined by the shadow cabinet, and it's determined by it's informed by our platform. These are all very collective decision-making processes. If there's a question as to whether there's a party before the commission and the party, and there's a potential perceived conflict where I have power to determine the outcome, then like I've done before with respect to an anti-dumping matter, I would actually consider the situation, and if I thought there was a perceived conflict or a conflict, I certainly would, of course, find out I would absent myself from that role. I've done that before. I'd do it again. It's only proper. And, of course, ministers have to do that from time to time for all sorts of perceived conflicts of interest.
Because Labor, for example, has been arguing, fair enough, that Peter Dutton should have stood aside from various childcare policy decisions.
Well, Peter Dutton is
because
alleged,
of a family interest
well,
in childcare.
Peter Dutton is an owner of a company that's receiving directly or indirectly, I'm advised it's directly, Commonwealth money. That's directly a beneficiary of a childcare policy. I don't think it's comparable. I'm not suggesting I won't consider my obligations as minister. I'm very sensitive to the need to do that. I'm very attentive to that. But I would say to you that a pecuniary interest where you're the direct beneficiary of taxpayers' money arising out of a cabinet decision to pay childcare centres is certainly one which would need a minister to absent him or herself. And if Mr. Dutton did that, then that's what I think that's quite right. I think that's certainly, I mean, you can draw a comparison, but I think they're somewhat different. I'm not deriving a benefit, and nor would I be deriving a benefit, but the policy itself, of course, is determined collectively. But I make the point again, the minister in this portfolio has situations where they might be making a decision, unlike the Fair Work Commission making the decision or others making decisions. In that circumstance where it was left to me to make a decision, then, of course, as I did before when last in government, if I thought there was a perceived conflict of interest, I would make sure I avoided that perceived conflict.
Let's turn to the ACTU's agenda. It's pressing very vigorously in a number of areas to give extra rights to workers and unions, including in relation to collective bargaining. Now, how much of the ACTU agenda would Labor implement?
Well, we'll implement Labor policy, and will that be informed by ACTU negotiations? Well, yes, we'll listen to the ACTU, and we always have listened to the ACTU as we listen to employers. I think sometimes it's overstated the extent to which the unions impact on policy. For example, many of the matters that the ACTU now raise were announced by the federal opposition before the 2016 election. For example, a statutory definition of casual. I announced that in 2015. Making sure that labour hire workers are paid equally to direct employers. Bill Shorten and I announced that some months ago, you know, and it was a policy we developed over 6 to 9 months. Our consideration of the labour market is this. The world has changed dramatically. The labour market has changed dramatically since even the introduction of the Fair Work Act. And we didn't anticipate, I believe, in hindsight, the speed and nature of the change, and we have to respond to what exists now. We're not interested in turning back the clock. We're interested in ensuring that the current industrial relations laws work for 2018, not 2007, or 1975, or all these absurd claims that people make about what Labor's policies are. Yes, we'll negotiate with the ACTU, but we will write our policy, and we'll be determining that. But, of course, we listen to unions and employers. They, of course, have to work under the arrangements, the system. And therefore we need to talk to them directly, and we will do just that, and we'll continue to do just that.
So in the simplest terms, how different would the industrial relations landscape be under a Labor government, say, in 3 or 4 years' time after the election than it is now, just in specific terms?
Look, as I say, we've already said that we need to clarify the use of casual, and in recent times we've seen a federal court decision come out and say that too often employers have used a subjective test for casual. They've sort of effectively said you're casual and somehow believed if they deemed a person to be casual rather than looking at the characteristics of the work, they were casual. The federal court of Australia have found that to be a nonsense. You look at the characteristics. If there's firm advance commitment to ongoing work, then clearly the worker could be permanent, and I think that's in keeping with Labor's reasoning. And that's just a recent decision of only 2 weeks or so ago. So that's one area we'd like to fix, a statutory definition of casual to clarify the delineation between permanent and casual. We'd like to see Labor hire workers treated properly. We'd like to see sham contracting, where you're forcing workers to be called independent contractors so you can pay them $7 an hour, and that happens now with, you know, Deliveroo riders and other workers. We'd like to see that being targeted. We'd like to see much greater penalties for systemic and intentional underpayment of workers, like in 7-Eleven, where there was over $140 million underpaid to its workforce by one company. And we believe that that underpayment is widespread and systemic, and therefore we do need greater enforcement and greater capability of ensuring that employers choose not to go down that path. We'd like to see a framework where the low-paid stream of the current Fair Work Act is not working sufficiently, and we believe that there are workers who need a form of industry bargaining or low-paid stream bargaining, sector bargaining, if you like. That is currently the provisions of the Fair Work Act, therefore we think that would be... But there's been not one successful application arising out of the low-paid stream that was a provision of the Fair Work Act. So we look at that form of bargaining. We want to introduce paid domestic violence leave, which is now being embraced by many, many companies, Telstra, Virgin, Qantas, NAB Bank, and so on. We think that the government hasn't gone far enough. And we'd like to see the restoration of penalty rates so that low-paid workers in retail and hospitality are not having their wages cut at a time of the lowest wage growth in a generation.
So how much are you talking to business about these changes, and what are you saying to those people in business who say, well, these will put more of a burden on companies?
Yeah, look, we're talking to all the peak employer bodies. I'm a regular attendee at ACCI functions, and I speak directly with James, the CEO of ACCI, James Pearson, and I speak with Innes Willocks, and I speak with all employer bodies, and they've not refused to talk to anyone.
And what's the feedback?
Well, look, you know, they would obviously... there are things that they would not like. They'd rather see penalty rates cut, I think, quite frankly. But we just say, at a time when we're seeing the lowest wage growth in a generation, the idea that you cut the wages of some of the lowest paid in this country is unfair and unreasonable, and we don't accept it. Now, they don't agree with us on that, but they understand our position. We're very straight with them on that. We're very clear. It's not like we've hid that. We've introduced private members' bills seeking to do it in this parliamentary term. So we're going to have a direct and honest relationship with all stakeholders, including employer bodies and employers. I meet with employers regularly. Any employer who seeks to meet me will certainly meet me or my office. We're open to discuss all matters in my portfolio, and that will continue up until the election, and if we're elected, beyond the election.
Now, within Labor, there's a great deal of division about the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. Do you think this will hit Australian workers?
Look, when you say there's division, I think there was a very important debate to be had about the TPP, and say that there are real issues we have about provisions of the TPP. And I think the division was more about, do we accept the TPP, flawed that it is, and seek to fix it in government, or do we seek to abandon the TPP, which is effectively abandoning a multilateral trade agreement in our region. And I think it was a very difficult decision for us to make. But we fell on the side of saying we'll seek to fix it in government.
And there's debate about whether that's possible.
Well, it is possible. It's just whether we succeed in everything we want to do. It is possible in that Prime Minister Ardern successfully through bilateral communications removed the application of certain provisions of that agreement.
That was at an earlier stage, though.
It was still subject to negotiation, and we would say we will have an ability to do that. There's something else we can do too, Michelle, which is we can change our domestic laws, for example, with respect to visa arrangements, that does not offend the TPP. That is, we can do it regardless of the being signatory to the TPP, just like other countries that are signatories can qualify and mitigate the effects of the TPP by changing their domestic legislation in relation to how you would apply temporary work visas, for example. So there's a series of ways you can mitigate any adverse effects, and also you can negotiate bilaterally with countries, and we'll be seeking to do that, and it'll be a priority. Now, and the reason now we want to do that is our concern is that labour mobility, if unchecked, could be very disadvantageous for certain sectors of our economy, and I think for that reason we need to make it a priority.
Just more generally on temporary workers coming into Australia, do you think there needs to be more change to the 457 visa scheme?
Look, I'd have to have another look at the efforts. I think the government bungled, because it was done sort of more by media release than policy thinking, I think they bungled the way they went about it just recently. We believe that there should be demonstrable evidence of shortage of a particular skilled worker before you get to have someone come from overseas. That's the first thing. So the labour market testing has to be verifiable and demonstrable. And, of course, the government paid lip service with labour market testing because they, quite frankly, why do they need work choices if you can completely loosen up labour market testing and overuse and misuse temporary workers? So as the former immigration minister and now Shane Newman, the shadow minister, I certainly like to make sure we've got that right. And but we have to go further than the 457s. The holiday maker and the student visas are important visas, but they have also been misused. That is, there are too many occasions where people have come to Australia not to study primarily, but to work, and they're granted student visas. For those that are here primarily to study in proper courses, vocational or tertiary, of course they need limited work rights, and we have the same rights afforded to our citizens when we study overseas. But if you look at the explosion of these visas issued under the student visa category, you can see that many of those visa applicants are actually working here and just enrolling in a Mickey Mouse course.
If you're looking, for example...
And the same with holiday makers. There's holiday maker visas who don't go on holidays. They just work 7 days a week.
If you look at the agricultural sector, though, there's been pressure to get more workers in because we don't seem to be able to supply enough from the domestic market.
That's true. Look, so that's what we have to be very mindful of this. Our labour market is very uneven, and our demand in our... And getting people to certain areas of Australia and certain sectors of our economy require supply of labour, without a shadow of a doubt. So, of course, we will need to use temporary workers in circumstances like agriculture and other sectors of our economy that have labour shortages. I'd also say that agriculture, the sector, must clean up its act, because there's been too many examples of egregious conduct by a minority of rogue employers where they've treated these workers abysmally. And if we can clean up that conduct, then, of course, I certainly don't have a problem that we supply the labour that's needed. We should do that. But equally, we'd expect that the employers, not just in agriculture, but elsewhere, everywhere, show a duty of care towards those workers. But even on construction sites in CBD, we've seen the misuse of temporary visas as recently as the hospital being built in Hobart, where we found Chinese workers on student visas being paid well below conditions of employment and really not being properly inducted, so therefore missing out on health and safety information. That shouldn't happen in a capital city in supposedly an organised industry like construction, but it does. So we do have to be very mindful of that.
Now, just finally, we've seen in recent days a couple of initiatives on the front of women's policy for women workers, superannuation, publication of information about companies' gender pay gaps. Can we expect that Labor will unveil more policies in coming months addressed to the female workforce?
Well, firstly, these are really critical policies. Firstly, when I was housing minister and dealing with people at the risk of being homeless, I was shocked to see the extent to which women, older women, often without any retirement savings or very little retirement savings, and find themselves, even though they'd worked through most of their life, they weren't caring for either a parent or their children, unable to, even afford the rent. And I'm sure, and there were many others, including Tanya Plibersek, who would have seen that as housing minister when last in government. And the announcement made by Chris Bowen and Tanya and myself on ensuring that we have better transparency around gender gap and making sure that it's reported publicly is a very good one for those employees over 1,000 staff. And I also think the announcement on super to reduce get rid of the 450 threshold will favour low paid workers, the majority of whom happen to be women who have a much lower superannuation saving compared with men, and we need to attend to that. And as for whether we have more to say, the answer is yes, Michelle. We do have other things we're looking at that can close the gender gap and also provide for better retirement savings so women are not so vulnerable and can have a decent quality of life during their working life and after it.
Brendan O'Connor, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for our Conversations political podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back for another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.